Hi, everybody. Michael Thiessen here for Liberty Coalition Canada. Today, I am interviewing Dr. Christopher Shaw. And Dr. Christopher is a Canadian neuroscientist. And thank you for coming on and being with us, Chris.
Thanks, Mike. I'm happy to be here.
So you and I are both really interested in liberty. You just wrote a book called Dispatches from the Vaccine Wars, Fighting for Human Freedom During the Great Reset. And that was released on August 31st. I'm running a podcast called Liberty Dispatch. So we both like that idea of trying to air ideas, getting good information out into a culture war, or what you're talking about specifically for you, it's a vaccine war. So why don't you walk us through the writing of the book? When did you start writing it and how did it come together? Our listeners would love to hear about that.
Well, okay. So I'll start off with the acknowledgement that I am a neuroscientist, as you've mentioned, and I'm not an MD. So I look at things from the perspective of neuroscience. So my training is, specifically in neuroscience, but, broadly trained in a lot of aspects of biology and in including medicine. I've served as a medic in various places. I started writing the book because I was becoming concerned, and this is before COVID. I started it actually the fall of 2019. I was becoming concerned that the push for mandates for vaccines in general and the media portrayal of people who were resistant or hesitant to go along with the CDC or Health Canada schedule were often, the commentaries were often very hostile and often quite wrong in my view. And I thought maybe with my training, I could bring some balance to that and try and look at the entire issue of vaccine development and safety primarily, and see where that led. And again, to do that, I was going to read everything in the literature that I could find. I was going to read everything on the CDC's website, for example. I was going to look at the FDA. I was going to look at Health Canada and all the kind of things they say about safe and effective, and deal with that whole notion that keeps coming up all the time from some people that the science is settled, which as a scientist is a profoundly non-scientific thing to say. In fact, it is a statement of cult religion, in my view, because science is, and that convinced me. So I'll just have a segue here. Two things I learned in writing the book, and starting with that, was that number one, an awful lot of people don't understand what science is, and they don't understand what it can do and what it can't do. And they assume science proves things, which it definitely does not. That's mathematics or logic, but not science. Science looks at it is a probability based on experiment and observation that can get stronger, and it can asymptote towards 100%, but it never gets there. Because all it takes is one experiment to throw it on that whole hypothesis or a theory on its ear. And we've seen that time and again in the history of science. So number one, an awful lot of people don't know what they're talking about when they talk about science. So when you hear people say, trust the science, follow the science, I believe in the science, the science is settled, you're looking at people who really don't know what it is, because, again, science evolves. And I wanted to, that was the big take home lesson. And, essentially I came to realize that a lot of educators, probably including me, have failed over the years to teach students to really understand what science actually is and what it's not. And that is a glaring failure that I can see. And again, you hear, you hear public figures, politicians, say these things that are just frankly absurd. That was one. And the second thing that really came out of the writing of the book, and especially during the pandemic, is how many of our fellow citizens here in Canada, how many in the United States, how many in other places, are essentially authoritarian in their thinking. They basically want to suppress stuff they don't like. And, we've seen that a lot, primarily with the left, sadly, in cancel culture. Things that are anathema to them, and rather than simply combating it with their own facts and figures and their own interpretation and their own analyses, they would rather just shut it down. And that's, for me, that's not the way I was raised. Certainly, growing up as in a leftist home, we always debated stuff constantly. And that's how we, you know, we got our views across, and we tried to synthesize our views with those of others and see where we thought we were right and they were right. And that doesn't happen anymore. And so the, you know, the attempt to suppress different perspectives that really came to the fore during COVID was actually really shocking to me. I didn't realize that it was like that, like a giant Stanley Milgram experiment, that we were watching people basically being told by, you know, people in authority, people in white coats or people in business suits or whatever it was, that they had to behave in a certain way. And not only that, but to essentially penalize people who thought differently. And that was shocking, because it was a Stanley Milgram experiment, and we're still in it. And that's, you know, and we see it with, you know, with the mandates and with lockdowns and with all those kinds of things, are basically trying to shame people and into behaving in a certain way. And, you know, when you look at kind of the incentives that are put out there for people to get the vaccine, such as, you know, Jason Kenney offering $100 to everyone who goes and gets it, or here in British Columbia, basically telling you you're now a second class citizen because you're not going to comply with vaccine mandates. These are things that are explicitly forbidden by the Nuremberg Code, by the Helsinki documents, by almost all the ethical documents that were created after World War II to allow people to choose or not choose to be part of any medical experiment. And this is a medical experiment. And so the kind of commentary that I see all the time, I'm on Facebook, and, you know, my friend list is fairly extensive, but very diverse. And a colleague of mine, I won't mention him, and I'm not a scientific colleague, but someone I've known for many years in various political battles, basically put out a really simple thing the other day. And he said, I love all my friends, and I respect those who have chosen to do this or chosen to do that. And I respect their choices because they're adults and they made adult choices. And I just would like to have some sort of dialogue where we can realize that we get to make those choices as human beings. And to his shock, not to mine, because I'd expected it, he got savaged by a lot of people on his Facebook, friend list, because they said, you can't be saying that. You can't say that anyone who refuses the vaccine should be your friend, or that they have anything rational to say. And you could literally see him knitting his brow, thinking, how is it possible that people I thought were allies and friends are behaving in this manner? And he tried and tried and tried again. And every time he would just get slapped by people who just said, oh no, there's only one side to the story.
Yeah, and if you think about it, his post was trying to have a dialogue where maybe we might find some common ground. Mm-hmm. And I want to draw out some of your expertise as you wrote the book. I want to draw out some of the things that you learned. So within the vaccine world, the dialogue is really loaded right now. I have been lumped together with anti-vaxxers, even though I have been interviewing doctors and nurses who would promote traditional vaccines and be totally comfortable with them. Vaccinologists and immunologists who are speaking out and concerned, they're getting lumped as anti-vaxxers, and their entire career has been developing vaccines.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, you think of Professor Brian Byron Riddle.
Yeah.
That's exactly what's happening to him.
Yeah. And if you listen to him, I've interviewed him. You listen to him, you're talking about a measured, calculated, responsible researcher. What are some things that people need to be aware about when we think about the science behind vaccine development?
Okay. So one thing I did is, and I had never read Edward Jenner's original articles before, but I did. I went forward and read them. And they were fascinating. And whether or not his methods and his, you know, what we, you know, we have to do, you know, now when we do experiments involving people, we have to go through an extensive process of having those procedures reviewed by an ethical board at our universities. And, you know, they exist at different levels as well. And the same for doing animal experiments. So that didn't occur in the 1790s. Okay. And so Jenner, you know, didn't have those same kind of guidelines in front of it. So would his experiments have been done today? No. But, you know, that was 200 and some years ago. What came through reading his articles and reading about him was he was a very decent human being. He was sort of a Renaissance man in a lot of ways. He did lots of things. And he saw this terrible scourge of smallpox. And because he was a physician and a caring man, he tried to find a way to modify what had been called variolation to basically make it effective to prevent smallpox. And his insight, and I think his genius, was recognizing you don't actually have to give someone smallpox to prevent them to get it again, but you can actually give them a related virus, the cowpox. And that came through a series of observations, which I think were very, very clever and very, and he developed it. He developed it from there. And I have a lot of respect for that because, again, a man who saw human suffering and he tried to alleviate it. Yep. And he gave his discoveries away for free. Yes, he got remunerated very handsomely later by the British Parliament, but not at first. Now, you know, that took years. So I think he was a good man, but I think he set in motion a train that ultimately became captured by market forces and became far too valuable for them to ever back off of. And so it became like that old Japanese adage, you know, if your only tool is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So for every infectious disease, there had to be a vaccine. For every infectious disease, there had to be multiple vaccines and taken multiple times. And then I think it just became so out of control that the assumptions undergirding that really became sort of like a cult religion. You could not question it. To question it was to instantly be anti-vaccine or an anti-vaxxer, which is an epithet.
Was there a time in your research where you really found, okay, here are some problematic moments in the development of vaccinations, or was it just really recently?
1986, when the Americans passed the vaccine compensation bill, and basically gave companies product basically get out of jail free from any liability. That really set that in motion. And when you no longer have liability for your products, and your products aren't thoroughly tested, or not tested against all the populations that might receive them, I think whether it's anything, whether it's, you know, paint with lead in it or anything else, or seriously, anything, when there's a profit motive, I think science gets badly corrupted. And I think that would really set the stage. I think until 86, it was more or less in control. Yes, the companies made good money on the vaccines they produced, but that was when it all changed. I think, and that upward spiral of things like autism started to happen. Do I necessarily think that vaccines cause autism? Not necessarily. No, I would, you know, if you ask me, you know, for example, I'm primarily a Lou Gehrig's researcher. So if you ask me what causes Lou Gehrig's disease, there's some genetic propensity. There are some dominant genes that can give you a motor neuron loss. There are some that seem to facilitate it if certain toxins are in place. And there's probably a lot of different ways to get it. So the same is true for autism. I don't think it's purely vaccine, but I think for some individuals, we don't know why, some of them are going to be susceptible to the stuff that may be in vaccines. One of them is the stuff I've been studying for years, which is aluminum. Aluminum is a toxic substance in your body. You know, it's a great thing to make outboard motors and airplanes and cars out of, but it's not great to have floating around in your body because it doesn't have any role in biology, no beneficial role anyway. So I think, and that was that, you know, that was another choke point when they started to make adjuvants. I don't know if you know the whole story of
when they started to make what?
Vaccine adjuvants. These are things that make the vaccines work better.
Right.
So, you know, much like as we're seeing what's called secondary vaccine failure happening with the mRNA vaccines that are being used in North America and elsewhere, is basically their efficacy diminishes over time. So not only do antibody levels go down and T cell levels go down and memory cells don't remember as well, over time. And that's true for a lot of vaccines, but it's usually not as fast as the mRNA vaccines have shown. That was occurring back in the 1920s. And then a group in Britain at Burroughs Wellcome Laboratories basically were, you know, really struggling to understand why they were losing antibody levels. And they started looking around for something they eventually called adjuvants, which is something that's going to help your immune system and boost it to make that immunity last longer. And they did. And I don't know how many compounds they tested. They tested a lot. Some of them were frankly toxic. And then they hit upon various aluminum salts and aluminum potassium sulfate, aluminum hydroxide, various others. And I guess the rationale was, well, you know, it's been, and aluminum is around everywhere and it's used. And then in 1926, it wasn't that heavily used. But, you know, it seems to be fairly benign. And look what it does. The immune response just goes crazy. great, let's put it in vaccines and we'll get a longer immune response. And that's true, you do. But aluminum, again, being toxic, basically has a lot of potential issues, especially as the vaccine schedule changes and this goes in lockstep with the market, which is, of course, the vaccines are profitable. So let's just make more of them for everything you can possibly think of and make kids take them and essentially vaccinate everybody. And, as we've seen with Moderna and Pfizer, they made out insanely well last year. I think Moderna made something like $19 billion just alone on their vaccine. I don't know about Pfizer, but I mean, they all did well. This is not whatever it was back in 1926. These are not products that do not have an enormous amount of financial clout and really increase a company's bottom line very dramatically. And so, as you know, Pfizer and Moderna and the others are trying to come up with a combined influenza COVID vaccine. And the money train just keeps rolling because then they're going to need one for the Delta variant and the Mu variant and the Lambda variant. There's a lot of Greek letters left. So they're going to play this game forever. And why wouldn't they? They are in the ultimate sweet spot. They get paid to develop these products. Then they get to sell them to the same people who paid them to develop them, and they're liability free. And I can't imagine a more perfect corporate solution to their bottom line.
So I have two questions for you then to follow up on what you're sharing there. Number one, I thought aluminum had been taken out of all vaccines in Canada.
You're thinking mercury, yes. Okay. Except for influenza. The substance called thimerosal, which is a kind of ethyl mercury, is still in influenza vaccines in North America. And it, obviously not as much as it used to be, because they used to put a thimerosal in essentially any multi-user vial. In other words, you're putting a needle into this vial over and over and over again. And if your sterile technique is not that good, and almost nobody's is that good, you're going to get bacterial contamination. Okay, eventually.
Yeah.
And so the idea is thimerosal would kill the bacteria so that you're not injecting bacteria with your vaccine. And that was the origin. It doesn't, mercury, but it also, as you know, mercury is very neurotoxic. And the idea that a lot of people had for a while was, and maybe still, I think Bobby Kennedy Jr. still believes, that mercury had a lot to do with the rise of autism. And I don't think he's entirely wrong. I don't think he's wrong at all. I think, you put various ingredients that are toxic in animal cells or in human cells into the body, you're going to get a problem. And a lot of these things go right to the brain and they do damage. And again, aluminum just doesn't have a role in biology.
All it so can do, aluminum is still in North American.
Yeah, it is in something like 2/3 of pediatric vaccines, for example.
Okay.
So you get the DPT shot, you get a whole bunch of others. You're going to get a bit of aluminum. So the argument is, well, it's very little, which is true. So I've got a cup of tea here, and people say, well, there's more aluminum in your tea than in the vaccine, and that's quite true. However, it's not going to the same place.
Right.
So the whole trajectory of aluminum that you imbibe or eat is not the same as the stuff you inject, because then you're very. And the Girardi group in Paris has very clearly shown that injected aluminum gets picked up in the muscle or the skin and transported by macrophages around the body. And some of it winds up in the brain and it doesn't seem to come out. So again, aluminum has all kinds of, it's a fascinating element chemically, but a lot of the stuff it does in biological systems is extremely, extremely harmful.
Does your book touch on the difference between these traditional vaccines that it would seem you already have some concern with, and you're ready to dialogue about those concerns, versus the actual new generation of vaccines or the experimental vaccines? Can we talk about your research on the new vaccines that have been put forward with warp speed, and both Trump and Biden, our U.S. counterparts, and then of course our continuous, our leaders, conservative and liberals, have all been celebrating. So this has not been, you're right, it's not been a left-right situation. You and I were talking about that a little bit before we came on camera. It's been a one-sided conversation. So you're in the midst of it doing research. What did you find about the new vaccines?
Well, I mean, the research I've done is, I mean, we are going to do some that's going to be experimental, but up until now, it's mostly just reading the literature and reading the phase trials. for both safety and efficacy. Well, it's a for example, let's talk about the mRNA vaccines. This is a completely novel technology for application to humans. I mean, people have been playing with this kind of idea for a long time. And the idea is, if you put the messenger RNA for coding a particular piece of protein into a cell, and you can make it attached to something called a ribosome, you can make them churn out that protein. And the idea is that these proteins now go to the surface of the cell. They kind of decorate the surface of the cell, and they attract immune cells. We recognize this as foreign, and then they develop the immune response based on the memory cells, the T cells, and which generate antibodies. And now the next time your body sees that protein, in this case the spike protein, they're going to go, aha, it's an invader, it's COVID again, let's go get it, and we'll never catch COVID. That's the idea. But they've never done this before, and the animal experiments that were done before were not routinely successful. And they also tended not to, and they also had various kinds of mortality issues in the animal studies. When they actually did a distribution study in one of the early papers in 2012, what they found was that the mRNA, and the mRNA is not the exact same mRNA that the virus itself would use. It is an artificial construct. It has some changed nucleotides that make it a little different. And then they encapsulated in this lipid capsule that tends to also have different characteristics than natural lipids. If you remember back in beginning of the pandemic, when Moderna and Pfizer were first talking about their vaccines, remember the cold storage discussion?
I don't know if I remember that one. Please remind me. There's been so many discussions that I...
So they were both saying, this is probably early in 2020, the summer of 2020. And they were basically saying, look, the stuff is so degradable that we have to transport it at minus 80 degrees Celsius or minus 20.
I do remember that.
Yeah. I do remember. And, and universities all over, medical laboratories and hospitals were madly buying, minus 80 freezers to store the vaccines in. Well, it turns out that story was not entirely correct. What happened in the laboratories of Moderna and Pfizer, I don't know, but we now know with some certainty that the products kind of go everywhere. In other words, the spike protein can be found almost everywhere in the body for some time after the injection. And so it doesn't just stay in your deltoid muscle where you inject it, it tends to wander around. And spike protein itself is toxic. So when it's binding to different kinds of cells, it is doing two things. One, it's damaging the cells. And number two, it is triggering immune response against those cells. So that's one thing we know. And the second thing is that the mRNA construct in its little lipid coating also goes all over the place. So a colleague of mine at UBC has found the spike protein in saliva after injection. There was several papers that came out and showed that the mRNA shows up in different organ systems, and it shows up in breast milk. Okay, so that whole cold storage thing seems largely not to have been correct, at least in the real world. And in the laboratory, maybe that's what they saw, but in the real world, it's not true.
It's not true that it's very degradable. Delicate.
No, it's not as delicate as they thought. So the original idea was, hey, listen, this stuff is gone in a couple of hours. You put in your deltoid. It does its thing. It stimulates your immune response. You make spike protein, and your immune cells remember this, and then it gets chewed up by various enzymes and it's gone. Well, no, that's not true. So that's the kind of thing you'd probably want to know a lot more about in terms of distribution, in terms of consequences, before you mass vaccinate much of the population of North America.
Okay, I want to ask a follow-up question before you move on, because you're giving us lots of great information. But when you said that there's little differences in the mRNA and there's little differences in the lipid, wouldn't minute differences mean something as to the efficacy?
Yeah, and that's what they were afraid of. They were afraid it was going to degrade so fast that it wouldn't work well. So they solved it. But again, they didn't test it for very long to see what the consequences would be. And one of the consequences in that initial mouse study, which was carried out by a subsidiary of Moderna, basically showed you could get you could get the mRNA in various organ systems, including brain. As a neuroscientist, I see that and I think, I don't think that's a good thing. It shouldn't be there, number one. And B, the argument is, well, it's very little. Yeah, it's very little compared to the deltoid. On the other hand, there should be none. And there is some. So what happens in the brain of an adult when this goes in there? What's going to happen? What happens if it goes into a kid? And now they're talking about pushing it down to five-year-olds. What happens now?
Yeah, that was in the news all day yesterday. 5 to 11, yeah. Pfizer. Yeah.
They don't know. And that's why this is a giant experiment. And that comes back to the whole idea that if it's a giant experiment that you're asked to participate in, A, you get to say no. And B, they can't coerce you and incentivize your choice by either punishment or rewards. Not if you're going to accept Helsinki and Nuremberg anyway.
And C, even according to some of the standards on human rights protocol that we would have in our experiments, they have to then closely monitor and observe any reaction, which, like, even more so, I would say, than if you've had a vaccine that has been observed for decades and decades and decades. Now, of course, everybody wants that observation, but I mean, like, that's literally in a typical research protocol.
Yeah. It has to be informed choice means they have told you the risks and benefits. Honestly, based on all of the literature, not just based on the safe and effective.
These spike proteins through the vaccination are getting into all parts of the body. Wouldn't they be getting into all parts of the body if I got COVID?
They might, yeah. I mean, we know from some of the initial epidemiological studies of the infection itself that yes, you find different organ systems are affected. It does go to, the virus can circulate widely. It can attack different cells. And they talk about the long haulers, right? People who have kind of now chronic injuries, including brain fog and things like that. So yeah, it can. I don't know that they have actually found the virus in the brain, but certainly finding neural effects, which suggests that either virus or some byproduct are getting into brain. But so can the vaccine products. And that's potentially a big problem because we don't know how long they last. We don't know how long these molecules are floating around. And again, it was based on the idea that, yes, the virus was so deadly and that it could go all over the body and it could cause different organ systems to fail. But the solution to it cannot, in my view, be to actually create the same sorts of molecules that are now basically very hard to degrade that are going all over the body too. And that's sort of the wrong way to go about it in my view. Yeah, I'm not a vaccinologist, so I don't play that game. But when I think about things going into your brain that don't belong there, whether it's toxins or funny molecules, I worry about that because I know what your immune system is going to do in your brain when they see that. They're going to destroy the cells that have it. That is not a good place to be for a nervous system. Neural cells do not routinely grow back in any numbers in adult humans or adult animals for that matter. And all of a sudden, if you have some sort of process that is now killing them, as you would in various neurological diseases, you're heading for, I think, a problem. I have an ex-brother-in-law who wanted to take the vaccines to protect our mutual ex-parent, mom and dad-in-law, and he's not in good shape. He's in kind of a permanent brain fog. He can't remember a lot of stuff now. This is not someone with comorbid conditions. This is a healthy guy. So that's disturbing.
Do you get into it into your book about the reporting adverse reactions? Or you just mentioned an anecdotal story, and virtually every interview I'm doing right now, individuals are mentioning anecdotal stories.
And that's what they are. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. But that being said, number one, in the middle of an experiment, and number two, just in a responsible medical system, somebody needs to be asking. See, science is when we observe and we then try to connect dots rather than not observe and say that has nothing to do with that, even though I've not thought about it for 1 second. So do you have anything in the book where you're talking about the reporting system or the lack of reporting?
I talk about the various reporting systems, but the one most of your listeners will know is the VAERS system, the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System. Which is interesting because it's a passive system. You don't actually have to report. And a lot of doctors just don't. They you know, again, this comes back to some of the cult behaviors. They deny any possibility that vaccines can cause any harm. Therefore, what you're experiencing can't be caused by the vaccine. Therefore, why would I report it? That happens a lot. Many doctors simply don't believe it. They just don't. And or, you know, they're busy people. I recognize that. And maybe they don't have time. Maybe they think it's just BS. Maybe, you know, I don't know. But the fact is, it's vastly underreported. I don't. In COVID, it may be more reported, but in normal times, vaccine injuries are reported about, based on a Harvard study, about 1% of the time. So there are probably a lot more than we know about. And yes, it is true that anyone can make a report, but it's also true that physicians at the CDC vet those. So if you're saying, well, we got the Martian vaccine and it turned my legs green, they're going to throw that one out. They're not going to keep that. You know, it does get examined. So it's not like these, you know, these raw assertions get put in there blindly. They just don't. So, you know, it's also interesting when you go through the CDC's list of, I went through 584 articles from 2020 to back to 2000. And a lot of them are, let's put it this way, a bit shaky. And even though various bloggers like to dismiss VAERS as being a flawed system, which it is, it's amazing how many of the CDC papers use VAERS when it suits them. So in other words, you know, if I use it, of course, I'm just an anti-vaxxer, but if someone else uses it who's working for the CDC, then it's perfectly fine. And that kind of discrepancy happens all the time. And of those 584 papers, a ridiculous number of them had those kinds of flaws in it. A ridiculous number of them also had just glaring conflicts of interest. In other words, they were sponsored by any number of vaccine companies. And they disclose that for sure. But again, you know, when someone's standing to make an awful lot of money based on a report, then you have to be a little skeptical of their motives. And some of them were just frankly really odd. I mean, some of the papers there were quite good, but a lot of them were just trash. And I don't think they would pass a master's thesis in a lot of places, thesis exam. So it was actually, you know, that was one of those things that was painful to do. But again, to be fair, I wanted to go through all the literature that everyone had and not just assume that I knew it. So, I mean, I didn't read 584 articles in great depth, but I certainly looked at all of them. And then I read about 125 of them in great depth. And I came away thinking that a lot of this is built on pillars of sand. It's not as solid, and the science is certainly not settled for a lot of things. And then, you know, I went back, you know, one of the other things I did, I went back and looked at the whole Wakefield thing, the whole Wakefield story. And that's an interesting story. And it's not as simple as you see in the media, where this horrible debunked doctor goes around killing kids. It's just not. It's a lot more interesting and a lot more complicated. And you know, I think they made Andrew Wakefield, the whipping boy, as kind of the shorthand for saying, okay, the science is settled. Anytime anyone has any questions about vaccines, we're just going to point at Andy Wakefield and blame him. Doesn't, you know, that's sloppy journalism and sloppy science for sure.
One of the things that I've been doing is shooting a lot of podcasts and talking to people, and it is really easy to do sloppy investigation.
Oh, yeah.
It actually is uber easy.
Yeah, look at CBC.
And when you're talking about reviewing these papers, you know, just because someone declares a conflict of interest, it doesn't necessarily mean that the conflict of interest is then eliminated.
No.
Usually when I declare a conflict of interest, I get up from the board table and I leave.
That's right.
So that others, just thinking about that in the real world, if I'm a director of a corporation, which in Canada, churches are corporations because they sit as charities. If I declare a conflict of interest, I don't submit my paper for review. Like I declare a conflict of interest and say, around this topic, my voice should be silent because everything I'm going to say is slanted towards self-pleasure or self-interest.
Absolutely. Now, if I'm sitting in a review panel, or even reviewing someone else's paper, if I know them well, and whether I like them or don't, I have to step away from it. I can't review that grant or that, and you know, that it's done on the honor system. And I think most people are pretty good about that. But yeah, when people declare, you know, you look at some of these papers and they have like 15 pharmaceutical companies backing their work, that would be kind of probably the people you wouldn't want to write that paper. And, you know, routinely, do they find negative stuff? No, they don't. They find positive stuff. And that's because, do I think they get up in the morning and say, listen, I'm just going to go do this fraudulent experiment? No, I don't think they do. But, you know, when someone's paying the bills, there's a tendency to find kind of what that something or someone wants. I think it's that part is human nature. You know, if grant money is hard to come by, let's be clear, but I think some of them are so conflicted that it's a bit much. And, you know, you look at someone like Paul Offit, if you've heard of him, who's made an awful lot of money on his Rotatec vaccine, who actually doesn't even declare that anymore. He just kind of blithely ignores the fact that he's made millions of dollars. And others do too. And they basically don't even declare the conflicts a lot of the time. So I'm some of your listeners might say, well, you know, Shaw, you know, you got a book out, so you want to sell a lot of copies, so you're going to say negative things. Okay, well, you know, take that aboard. You know, sure, maybe I have a conflict too, but at least, you know, again, at least I'm declaring it. I'm certainly not going to make the kind of money that the vaccine manufacturers are making.
Yeah, for anybody who thinks that you're going to get rich off a book that's on Amazon that is talking about fighting for freedom in the middle of the vaccine wars, let's just be very declarative. The answer is probably the odds are against that book. You know, I've written a book on marriage, and I remember sitting around and wondering, oh, what would it be like if, and a good friend of mine who's been published by Oxford, and he's been published a number of different, written a few popular books, written a few academic books. He just sat back and one day he said, Mike, we write books because we believe in what we're writing. Because let me tell you, you know, my royalties for my Oxford published books, they are not paying the bills.
Honestly, you know, if I were to make money on this book, that would be lovely. Sure. But I decided a long time ago that I was going to tithe myself rather heavily for causes I believe in. And there are a number of them. And that whatever proceeds come my way, I'm going to cut it up in a lot of little pieces and send them to the things I believe in. For example, health freedom. So groups I know who are working in health freedom are going to get some of it. I am very much in support of the Kurdish revolutionary movement in Northeast Syria. They'll get some of it for the medics there. I very much support environmental stuff and land struggles by native peoples. They're going to get some of it. So, you know, it's not like it's all going to my bank account. I'm going to get a yacht and, you know, cruise the coast of Costa Rica. That's not going to happen. Right. Certainly not in this day and age. No, it wouldn't happen anyway.
You'd have to develop a vaccine that you could put in the book in order for it to, to... Okay. Yeah. So look though, I want to get to the next part of your book. So I think we've gone through some general caution. And again, I think the reason, you know, as you and I were talking about, we were talking about the fact that civil discourse around the vaccinations, like people who are vaccine hesitant or have done their research and they're concerned. My wife has done lots of research, and she also has been able to say, you know, I don't want aluminum pumped into my children. Is there another alternative?
There are, by the way.
Yeah. And again, I think that those are valid people doing valid research. We live in the age of knowledge. Like I can Google almost anything. Yeah. But then I think the book makes a turn and starts talking about a greater concern. So literally the subtitle is very catchy, and it is Fighting for Human Freedom During the Great Reset. So for those people who do not understand the economic theory or the proposals in the Great Reset or the author, could you please explain to us why you added that subtitle in this time?
One thing that became clear as the COVID story emerged was the call for, Bill Gates is, chief proponent of this. The pandemic doesn't end. We don't go back to normal until 7.5 billion people have a shot in their arms. Mirrored by Tony Fauci in the United States, mirrored by Theresa Tam here in Canada, mirrored by Justin Trudeau. Unfortunately, we have him for a little while longer. That are basically mimicking the words of this fellow named Klaus Schwab. Klaus Schwab is the director of the World Economic Forum, whose idea is that all the problems of the world, whether it's environmental degradation or injustice or inequality, can be solved by the same people who created the problems in the first place. In other words, the 0.0001%. In other words, the billionaires of the world who fly into Davos on their private jets are the ones you want to give the power to so they can solve the problems they created. Okay, interesting strategy. When you read Klaus Schwab's book called COVID-19 and the Great Reset, it's you're reading essentially a political tract. And I don't know if your listeners are aware that Klaus Schwab's dad was a real Nazi. I mean, a real Nazi in World War II. And Klaus is, to me, kind of a Nazi too. He's just nicer. He doesn't use derogatory terms for minorities. He talks all the woke words about environment and equality. And yet he's still the director of this institute that is essentially dictating to humans around the world how they should live. And there is a strong so-called transhumanism involved, where essentially, we're going to all, if he has his way, all become cyborgs, or some sort of variation. And where it essentially, it is not a liberty discussion. It is the opposite of liberty discussion. It is sort of more state control, but the state now belongs to the corporations and the World Economic Forum. They dictate what governments do. And if you remember Mussolini's statement from back in the day, it was that fascism should more properly be called corporatism because it is the merger of the state and corporations. Some people compare it to communism. Look, whether you call it communism or fascism, you're dealing with totalitarian systems. Right. And that's what Klaus Schwab wants for the world. He wants a controlled society where the people who have all the money make all the decisions for all of us. And that includes getting the vaccines. And all the time. And we're now talking about booster shots. In Israel, they're talking about booster shots every year, maybe sooner. This is now a controlled medical paradigm that you either take these things to go along or you get punished and you get degraded to second tier citizenship. That's what we've seen in Israel. That's what we see in Australia. That's what we're seeing here. And that was one of the disappointing things in Canada during the election. It was only the People's Party of Canada. I have some political issues with some of their things, but they were the only ones who were saying that this is wrong. All the other parties were going along happily. Yes, we need mandates. Yes, we need more ways to incentivize people. Completely in violation of all the treaties, and also, quite frankly, in violation of the actual science, not the science they like, but the science that is actually probably is beginning to come out.
So on this, I just want our viewers to be aware, in this time of conspiracy theories and in this time of really quick accusations being made, everything that Dr. Shaw is sharing with you right now, like you can literally go to Amazon and you can type in COVID-19, the great reset, and you can read in the bio for the book. So yeah. The endorsements for the book, A Call for Political Change in the Post-Pandemic World. History has shown, the book argues, that pandemics are a force for radical and lasting change. And so when we're talking about our world leaders mimicking this language, repeating the language used, you have to understand in the context of COVID-19 and the context of the book written, their language adds up to serious social, economic, and political change of systems.
And COVID-19 and the vaccines are just the pointy end of the stick. That's all they are. They are the means by which you push forward that agenda.
And this is why
transform human life.
This is why we at Liberty Coalition Canada, along with the PPC party, or along with our End the Lockdowns caucus, which had in it people like Maxime Bernier and Derek Sloan and Randy Hillier and other politicians that are concerned. We're greatly concerned that this has been a whole shift of worldview, a whole shift of systems. And so Dr. Shah, I'm thankful for you connecting that dot for us, where you're trying to say, look, you know, we've got a lot of money being made, but also we do have, in context, in history, a call for societal change. And I don't think enough people realize that situation. And that's why people like you and I might say, I wonder if we're ever going to get out of this. I don't think we're going to get out of this. How are we going to get out of this? People sit back and they go, well, of course we're going to get out of it. When the pandemic's over, we're going to get out of it. But they're not realizing, like you just said, that it's the stick that's poking us. It's the prodding iron that is brazen hot, pushing us towards a desired outcome. And the scary thing is that you just hear almost every world government repeating the same terminology, the same phraseology.
Absolutely. And so, when you hear that, you know they're reading a script, and they all say the same thing.
Right.
They're reading a script. Someone, I don't know who gave them the script, but that's what they're doing. They're reading a script.
Or even if you want to go one step further or one step back towards, like, they're all academics and they're all serious learners. Well, they're reading from the same book. Right. Like, so you know what it's like when a popular book goes through, like in our Christian world, you know, I can tell you what the next popular book will be based upon the first, you know, when I start hearing 10 pastors talk about a book, I can say, okay, that's going to be popular within the churches in the next 3 or 4 years. So even if it's all utterly just academic, philosophical investigation, which it can't quite be to be so on the same timeline. There has to be some agreement. Even if it is an innocent investigation, it is still the same thing. It is still a call to utilize the pandemic to make major changes in society.
And this is something the Klaus Schwabs and the Bill Gateses and their ilk have wanted to do for a long time. So that, you know, it also drives the question, you know, it was the pandemic simply a convenient excuse to do this and push through this agenda, or was there a little more active participation? And that's still an open question, actually, at least in my mind. I mean, I think the evidence that the virus has been bioengineered in Wuhan is pretty good, I think. And if that's true, then, you know, then who are the players? Who are the players involved in this? Who are the non-state players and the state players? And what was the agenda? Because certainly, I mean, you always have to ask, you know, the qui bono question, who got something out of this? Well, a lot of people got something out of this. A lot of people didn't. A lot of us didn't get anything. But, you know, when you look at all the billionaires who made an awful lot of money during the pandemic, and you look at the power of the various governments, and all governments will default into what's called state of exception if they can, which is essentially that they just decide what they're going to do and they just do it. They don't need the niceties of going through parliaments. This is how they roll, and this is, I think, going to be the future unless we stop it. I think we're going to see governments becoming more totalitarian. And again, call them fascist or communist, whatever you want, but they're going to become more totalitarian because we're letting them do it. And there was I use a Frederick Douglass quote in my book. You know, to paraphrase it, basically says, "You see what people will tolerate, and now you know the limits of what the oppressor will do, and they're going to keep putting the screws to you until they find that you finally rise up." That's how it works. It's always worked that way. And it's certainly, I mean, and one of the things that surprised me, someone asked me the other day, said, you know, why does it seem that Canadians, and to some extent Americans, why are we so passive when we see this happen? Well, you know, what has happened here that we don't see the rallies that you see in France or in Italy or elsewhere? You know, this is a country that is, you know, pretty much stood up to tyranny before. I mean, we fought, you know, far above our weight in both world wars. Now, I didn't think the Afghan war was a very good war, but having said that, you know, Canada did remarkably well there for what it was tasked to do. vastly beyond our weight. So we, you know, we're not a passive country usually. And what happened to us here? It did the propaganda and the endless repetition, you know, they all psychic driving just gets so strong. And when you hear CBC say the same thing 100 times a day, every day, you know, every day of the week, every day of the month, and people start to believe this stuff. And again, this is the Stanley Milgram kind of thing. A figure of authority tells you something, and it turns out most people will do it, and they won't question. And that's
and it really is a threat, right? So I face up to 3 years in jail, and I face up to $300,000 in fines just for keeping my church open in order to worship God when the state told me I wasn't allowed to. Again, even though I could drive down the street with all the same people and go into Walmart at the exact same time. So look, this has been very informative. Everybody, the book is called Dispatches from the Vaccine Wars, Fighting for Human Freedom During the Great Reset. Christopher, thank you so much for spending time with me and trying to, you know, walk through this journey of what you've written and some of the stories you're trying to share. I appreciate anyone who's willing to go in and do investigative research. So it's very clear from what you're describing that you know your stuff. When you speak and other people like Dr. Byron Bridle, it all makes sense. And when I say it all makes sense, I mean, it's a pretty balanced discussion. It's a pretty common ground discussion. It's a risk rewards discussion. Here's what we've learned about vaccinations and, you know, interact the way that you would like. But then we're also saying, okay, how did this train get so big that it can't be stopped? So I appreciate your insights. Thank you for sharing with us. I'll give you the last word and then we'll sign off.
Okay. Well, Mike, I appreciate your comments. I also do want to congratulate you. I think that keeping your church open and I think doing what your religion calls you to do was very important. And I really congratulate you on that. And I think that's very honorable. And I know you took some risks and other pastors have done it as well. I mean, I have friends in both Christians and Jews who are doing the same sorts of things and they're taking risks. And I have to say that I think they are being true to their religion. And so, you know, you're talking about real religion versus the cult religion that is being thrown at us. You know, science has settled, you know, have to believe it this way. You have to do this, you know, all those sorts of virtue signaling and shaming of people because they're not falling into the cult. And I think the contrast is really the people like you and the people. I just had a great interview with a fellow I've corresponded with a lot named Rabbi Zev Epstein out of New York. And I think you guys are keeping religious freedom alive, and I really appreciate that. So thank you. Thank you to you guys, all of you who are doing that.
Well, it's been a privilege to have you, everybody. If you can go and again, you can give us a 5-star rating. You can find our podcast on Apple, on Spotify, on Beanpod. We really appreciate when you give us that 5-star rating. It helps us increase on the review list. And in fact, we want to celebrate that we are on the top 15 in Canada for Canadian podcasts on government. And so We're pleased to keep presenting these things. Everybody, have a nice night and thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning in to this Liberty Coalition Canada interview, a united front to restore liberty and justice in Canada. Please subscribe to our podcast and Rumble channel, as well as visit our website at www.libertycoalitioncanada.com.